Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Global reaction to the mass shooting in Orlando. A British lawmaker is killed in an attack that brings the country's campaigning on the EU referendum to a halt. And more than 50 U.S. diplomats urge a reluctant President Obama to order military strikes against Syria's government. Joining me for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Yoki Driessen with Foreign Policy, Nancy Youssef at The Daily Beast, and Jeff Dyer with The Financial Times. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Hi, Susan. Good morning.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org, or you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, let's start with a scoop this morning. I believe it was in the New York Times that 51 State Department officials signed a memo urging the U.S. to carry out targeted airstrikes against the Syrian government. This is interesting, it seems to me, Yoki, because it is really at odds with President Obama's policy and because it's a significant number of diplomats signing it. Is that unusual?
It is. I mean, this channel was set up specifically for this reason. It was set up so that people who thought policy was wrong had a formal way to do it without fear of retribution. What's interesting to me about this, beyond the fact that it's so many, as you said, and beyond the fact that it's so different from what the White House is doing, is that there's no question that what the White House has said is its only strategy has failed. There's absolutely no question about that. They've said they're committed to a diplomatic solution, that they're invested in finding a diplomatic deal. Talks have broken down. Assad says he will reclaim by force every inch of territory that he was lost. So there's no question at all the strategy has failed. The question then becomes, what's the next strategy? And this could force the White House to either admit to the failure or potentially shift towards something that may not be airstrikes, but what's been called Plan B, which would be arming moderate rebels, doing other things in the margin that are more aggressive than what's being done now.
Well, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, has talked about you have to have a Plan B or else you have no negotiating leverage at all. Is this what he has in mind?
Well, what I thought was interesting in this is that the argument was that there should be more airstrikes against Bashar al-Assad, and it wasn't clear where, and it wasn't clear that that would be effectual in terms of bringing stability to Syria because, and perhaps this is a military correspondent in me, there's nothing to indicate that airstrikes alone will lead to the fall of Bashar al-Assad or the problems that plague Syria. And so I thought it was interesting that there's sort of this reach for a military solution from the diplomatic corps, no less, for a solution in Syria. And moreover, the efforts, as you talked about in terms of the diplomacy, have been quite challenging, but also arming moderate rebels in Aleppo, which is Syria's biggest city. The moderate rebels that have been armed by the United States are in big, big trouble. They've come under assault from Russian airstrikes, from ISIS in some cases. And so even those strategies that have been tried towards bringing down the Assad regime have struggled. And so where the solution comes from, not only in terms of bringing down Assad, but who would come after him and what Syria would look like, are still unanswered even through this cable.
So if there are all these unanswered questions about how it would work and if it would work, signing this is just a statement that what's currently happening is not working, Jeff?
I think that's right. I mean, I think what this tells you and shows you is that for the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a huge amount of dissatisfaction within the administration, within the bureaucracy about Syria policy. And the president has received lots of proposals over the last few years to do more, to either conduct airstrikes against the regime, to give more aid to rebels. And he's been very, very reluctant all this time to do that. He's afraid that these are just steps down a slippery slope that will pull the U.S. Fully into this war. And so he's been pushing back almost alone against a lot of the bureaucracy for the last few years. And just the fact that there are so many of these State Department officials signing this letter just tells you the amount of churn there has been within the bureaucracy, within the system, over Syria policy.
So, Yoki, what are the odds this prompts President Obama to rethink his opposition to these airstrikes?
Zero. I mean, I think he has made clear that he considers himself to have made a historically correct choice by keeping the U.S. out of what could be a decades-long civil war. One other point is worth remembering that the State Department under John Kerry has been more hawkish on Syria than the Pentagon for several years. You know, if we think back to right before the infamous Obama red line walk back, where first he said he would bomb Syria for the chemical weapons attack, then last minute he said he wouldn't. John Kerry was the person, not anyone from the Pentagon, who went out the day before to give a Churchillian desk pounding, this has gone too far, there will be repercussions, you know, the strongest possible statement of imminent use of military force. President Obama then reversed it the next day without telling him. But that was the State Department making those comments, not the Pentagon.
I would just say to that, what the Pentagon's commitment has been to is defeating ISIS, weakening ISIS, not answering the question of what happens to Syria. It has been extremely narrow, to the point that when we started seeing moderate opposition who've been armed by the United States coming under attack in Aleppo, the U.S. military position was essentially, that's not our problem, because that doesn't get at the question of ISIS.
Let's talk about the terrible shooting in Orlando this week, which we talked about in the first hour, in the domestic hour of the news roundup. What was the reaction around the world, Jeff?
Outpouring of sympathy, I think, was a simple way to describe it. Sympathy of the raw nature of the violence, but also a particular sympathy of the fact that it was a LGBT a gay club that was attacked that caused a huge amount of reaction around the world. So you saw, for instance, in Soho in London, a massive vigil of people turned out in sympathy to the victims. The London Gay Men's Choir sang a beautiful song. There were several thousand people there. You even saw a lot of sympathy in a place like Russia, which has come under a lot of criticism recently years for its 2013 law, which seemed to ban what they called gay propaganda. But even Russian foreign ministry officials came out in public and criticized some homophobic reactions that had been on the internet in Russia. So there's really a strong wave of sympathy, particularly around the LGBT aspect of this tragedy.
You know, that's interesting, because that's different than what we might have seen a decade ago.
Even 2 years ago, yeah. It would have been very different. I mean, it's a real sort of, you know, a mark of the way that the cultures change and the way that the people around the world think about these issues.
What about the ISIS aspect of this? Because we don't know, there's a lot we don't know about the shooter, but we do know that he was at least claiming some allegiance to ISIS.
Right, as was the case in San Bernardino. And there's been the fear, not just of, you know, so-called lone wolf attackers, people who don't have actual communications with ISIS, not receiving money from ISIS or directives from ISIS, but are drawn to the cause. And there's something very interesting and very scary that not long ago, Al-Qaeda was the group that if you wanted to carry out an attack and you wanted to just name yourself a terrorist to get global attention, you would say you were Al-Qaeda in Area X, Al-Qaeda in Area Y. Now you say you're part of the Islamic State. That was the case in London. That was the case in Paris in this horrible attack involving the policeman and his partner and their child, which I'm sure we'll get to. That was the case in San Bernardino, and now it's the case in Orlando. It was interesting that one of the comments that came out, you know, to Jeff's point about the sympathy, on the other end of it, the people in the Brexit camp, the camp that says let us leave the EU, part of that camp, an argument right after the Orlando attack was, there will be an attack in Britain like this because a deal, if we stay in the EU, will allow in too many Muslims, where it was an explicit fear tactic of saying, Orlando happened in America, this will happen here in England if Muslims keep coming. So you're seeing this outpouring of support on the one hand, but then you're also seeing the kind of Trump message spread to other countries of keep Muslims out because inherently they're dangerous.
One of the things that I took away as someone who's been covering the war on ISIS is we've seen a lot of territorial losses suffered by the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. By U.S. military estimates, 45% of the land they held in Iraq, 20% in Syria. And yet the group continues to be potent, that it is essentially a virtual caliphate. And in fact, as it's lost territory, we've seen it move towards less of a caliphate in the physical sense and more of a terror group. We've seen bombings in Baghdad. And in the run-up to this, in the run-up to Ramadan, we saw a message from a spokesman calling for people to do these kinds of attacks. And so the challenge is with the U.S. strategy is even as you lose territory, it doesn't eliminate the ISIS threat, because as long as they're able to inspire or lead people to do things in their name, they continue on. Even as it appears with each of these attacks, they have less and less actual say in terms of the operations, the funding, the directing of these attacks. So on one hand, if you go after the territory, you have the threat of these kinds of attacks. If you don't go after the territory, it's a breeding ground for them to train, direct, fund attacks like Paris and Brussels.
We want to talk about what's happening on the ground in Iraq in just a minute. But first, Jeff, tell us about this attack that Yoki mentioned in Paris of an off-duty police officer. Really a terrible story.
Another truly tragic and grim event from this week. He was an off-duty police officer. He was stabbed by someone who also claimed to be doing so in the name of ISIS, who apparently seemed to stream the event on his Facebook page while the attack was taking place. The police officer's wife was also attacked, and their three-year-old child was with them at the time. So a truly grim event. But it also it does shed some of the light on the slightly different kinds of challenges that law enforcement faces in Europe and faces in the U.S. In the U.S., with the Omar Mateen case, we've seen this complicated story this week of someone who had some sort of vague attraction to jihadi causes, but unclear just how strongly. But it self-radicalized, you think, over the internet, mixed in with a complicated story about maybe mental illness. In this case, what we see is someone who had a past history of support for terrorist organizations, was a hardened criminal, and spent time in prison. And what you find, particularly in France and Belgium, is these networks of ISIS sympathizers. A lot of them really have connections with convicts. A lot of them spent time in prison. Prison is often sometimes a place where they have become radicalized. It's a very different type of person, although ending up with the same very grim sort of action.
And so in both cases, known to law enforcement officials, thought perhaps to be a danger, and yet not stopped before the attack.
And in the French case, not only been in prison, but he'd been under surveillance for some time as well.
Jeff Dyer, he's the foreign policy correspondent for the Financial Times. And we're also joined this hour by Nancy Youssef, the senior defense and national security correspondent for the Daily Beast, and Yoki Driessen, managing editor of Foreign Policy. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be joined on the phone by Gabby Hinsliff. She's joining us from Oxfordshire in the United Kingdom. She's a columnist with the Guardian newspaper. She's going to bring us up to date on the latest that's happening there in the wake of the terrible death yesterday of Joe Cox. Stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And we're joined now from Oxfordshire in the United Kingdom by Gabby Hinsliff, a political columnist with The Guardian newspaper. Gabby, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We, of course, have been reading and hearing about the death of Joe Cox, a rising star in Britain's parliament, shot and stabbed to death yesterday. Bring us up to date on what we know now about this attack.
Yeah, I mean, the mood here is just very shocked, numb, disbelieving. People kind of can't take it in. We've thought of ourselves as a country where this sort of thing doesn't happen, where gun crime is rare. And we're still really trying to unravel what happened here. There is obviously a suspect being questioned by police, but it's unclear as yet exactly what his motive is. But the conversation here today is very much about reflecting on our political culture, I would say. We've been going through a very bitter, very angry referendum campaign on whether Britain should leave Europe. It's got very personal, and that's got people wondering, maybe that has nothing to do with this killing, but it has got people thinking, is this actually how we want to do politics? Is it safe to do politics amid this kind of climate of rage, really, and very personal attacks by politicians on each other?
Well, of course, Joe Cox was, as I understand it, an advocate of staying in the EU.
She was.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say she was also a very passionate advocate for the rights of refugees, and immigration has been a huge issue in this campaign. You know, so she was very much at the heart of the issues involved here. But as I say, you know, we don't yet know what the motivation for this attack was, whether this had anything to do with it or not.
Well, there were reports that the assailant shouted Britain first during the attack. Do we know now if that's correct, that he did indeed say that?
We have conflicting eyewitness reports. There are a couple of eyewitnesses who say they did hear him say something like Britain first or put Britain first. That's the name of a far-right political movement here, but it's also more generally used as a slogan for wanting less immigration. But then there are the eyewitnesses who say they didn't hear that, so it's unclear. It also looks as if the suspect who's currently being questioned, we know, had a history of mental health problems. And also there is some evidence of far-right sympathies. It looks as if he subscribed to a South African neo-Nazi magazine, for example. But that was back in the 1980s. So it's still unclear whether that is what drives it, or whether, you know, his mental state may have had more to do with it, or whether there's some other element that we're missing. You know, was there a personal grudge against her, or some issue that we're unaware of in the background? So there's a lot of debate about quite where this is coming from.
The Brexit vote, the campaigning on it has been halted for a day or two, but the Brexit vote is expected to go ahead next week. Is that correct?
Yes, I think it's kind of too late to call off the referendum now, but campaigning is suspended, I suspect, at least until the beginning of next week. No one really has the appetite for arguing about what feels like almost a petty issue now by comparison.
You know, we know that from polling that it's been a pretty close fight. We think the divide is pretty close in Britain. What kind of impact do you think this could have on the vote?
It's very hard to say. I think both the Remain and Leave sides are very wary of being seen to politicise this death by kind of, you know, saying it will go one way or other. But I think what it has made people do, there's been a lot of talk about how fragile, how precious democracy is. You know, it's being seen not just as an attack on one woman, but as an attack on democracy itself, you know, when politicians are executed doing their jobs. And I think what I think it really will do is make people turn out and vote. You know, Jo Cox gave her life to fighting for the things that she believed in, and quite literally seems to have paid the price of a life for that. The least the rest of us can do is turn up, vote, put a cross in a box. So I think it will be a very high turnout, and I think a lot of people will have her in mind as they vote.
Gabby Hinsliff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Gabby Hinsliff is a political columnist with The Guardian newspaper, and she was joining us from Oxfordshire in the UK. You know, I'm really struck by what seems to be a different response in the UK to a political assassination to what happens after shootings here. I mean, I'm thinking that they seem a little less, more reflective and less political in their response. Is that fair, Yoki, do you think?
I think that there's less fear-mongering there than here. I mean, post Orlando, you had every Republican who spoke to it say, this proves Obama's failing. I mean, John McCain had that really kind of offensive phrase that Obama was directly responsible for the atrocity and the massacre in Orlando. In Britain, you do I think part of it, as in Israel, is that this is a country that's seen terrorism before. It's seen politicians assassinated. It's seen attempts to kill politicians. It's seen car bombings and other attacks. Here, we sort of give in immediately to fear, anger, and now bigotry in a way that that country doesn't.
Nancy, what do you think?
I couldn't help but think about Gabby Giffords and what happened to her, which was quite similar. And there seemed to be an impassioned debate then. And what struck me is that both women really seemed to care about the issues and be really connected with their voters in a way that we don't often see. And I think in a way, because of that, there's a commitment to sort of talking about issues and not delving into sort of vitriol. Now, whether it leads to substantive change in the UK, we'll see. We didn't really see that here after Gabby Giffords' injury, even though here was a congresswoman who had been shot while meeting with her constituents. But you hear about Jo Cox and her compassion towards Syrian refugees, her eagerness to go out and really meet the voters, that it seems that it would be almost inappropriate to do anything other than, as Gabby said, go out and vote. And I think whether that leads to substantive change, we'll see. But we can't dismiss the value that it's leading to changes in rhetoric, because it has been quite ugly, the debate over the Brexit, just in terms of language.
Jeff, what kind of impact do you think this terrible attack is likely to have on next week's vote?
It's very hard to say in substantive terms, because we just don't know enough about the motives and so on. But I think what Gabby Hinsliff said, the most interesting thing was the issue about the turnout. That's where it really could affect the election. Because if it's a high turnout, that will favour the Remain camp. This is one of these elections where the passion is on the Leave side, on the people who want to leave the EU, on the Brexit side. So their base is more motivated because they're really highly strung up about this issue. And the risk for the government that wants to stay in the EU is that the people who want to stay don't actually turn and vote. They're not so motivated. They're not quite so interested. If this does actually lead to a much higher turnout than was previously expected, then that's probably very good news for the Remain camp.
Our friend Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, often a panelist here on the News Roundup, had an interesting column this morning where he talked about parallels between the impulse toward this Brexit vote and what we see in American politics happening in our presidential election, that there's really some discontent that's fueling prospects that we hadn't considered to be really very likely politically.
I mean, it's also interesting that in one case, though, in the case of the Brexit, you have a vote that's imminent. So you will imminently see, potentially, as Jeff mentioned, whether turnout is higher than expected. We will imminently see whether the Brexit happens or doesn't happen. In the presidential race, we're still unbearably 6 long months away from this hellish nightmare finally coming to an end. I mean, the Brexit, one way or another, it ends next week. In the case of this election, even though there are parallels, it will continue. Things will get uglier, most likely, because the kind of bigotry you're hearing is not dissipating. If anything, it's getting louder. And one can only wish that we were as close to a decision here as they are to in Britain.
Does the Brexit vote matter to America, to the United States, Nancy? Is this going to have implications for us?
Sure. I mean, in the sense that if you have a UK that leaves the European Union, there's fears of recession and potentially global recession, that this is not just in isolation of Europe, but has the potential of real effects on the world economy, depending on how it goes, particularly if the UK decides to leave. It's hard to see that it doesn't have some implications on the world economy.
Let's talk about what's happening in Iraq. There have been some big developments on the ground. News out just this morning, the Iraqi military says they took back a central government compound in Fallujah. That's a name a lot of Americans recognize because of the long U.S.-led war there. How significant is this, do you think? Yoki?
I think if Fallujah is retaken, and if it's retaken relatively quickly, it will be one step on a very important process. But the second test will be, once Fallujah is back in government hands, what's done to the Sunni population of Fallujah? There have already been reports, fairly credibly, that Shiite militias have been abducting, torturing, killing Sunni residents of the city as those Sunni residents tried to flee the fighting. If that continues, that suggests that the war for Mosul, which is the ultimate battle that will take place at some point this year or next year for Iraq and the U.S. on one side and ISIS on the other, if you do see evidence that Shiite militia, who are doing the vast bulk of the fighting, cannot be restrained, that their inclination is fight to take the city, and while you're doing it, kill as many Sunnis as you can, that would be one step forward on the battlefield, but one step massively backward in the sectarian strife.
I would just add to that it's domestically, the embattled prime minister there, Haider al-Abadi, needed this victory, particularly because there's a perception among some Iraqis that a lot of the bombings that have been inflicted on Baghdad in recent weeks are coming from fighters traveling by way of Fallujah. And I think just having this sort of military victory has been essential, given that he's been under tremendous pressure and facing internal strife over the future of his premiership. That said, how much effect Mosul would have on, or excuse me, Fallujah would have on Mosul is really not clear, because the city of Mosul was not essential to actually removing ISIS from its capital in Iraq, in the city of Mosul. And so this was a battle that the Iraqis wanted more than the U.S., and if it falls or appears to fall in the next few weeks, it would be faster than we anticipated, and it would be a huge boost potentially to the prime minister.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Florida Keys, Florida, and talk to Sean. Sean, hi, you're on the air.
Very pleasant. Good morning, all. You know, we discuss ad nauseum these conflicts that are going on in the Middle East. We try to discuss them in such a way that it makes sense. We understand them. We don't understand them. We created these problems, and creating these problems by what we're doing now is just creating further problems. We can't solve those problems. If we're going to do anything, let's take food over and try to get them some electricity and do a few things, but get the hell out of there. The only thing we're doing is continuing to follow along with what the British Empire did. They failed, just as the Romans did, just as every other empire has failed. We don't call ourselves an empire, but that's exactly what we're doing. And now they're coming over here, and we're worried about the terrorists that are going to be coming over here, and we're completely ignoring any kind of reality as to why they might be coming over here. We're over there blowing up all sorts of things.
You know, Sean, thanks very much for calling. You know, your comments are something like an email we got from Mohammed in Alexandria. He writes, why do you and the U.S. media pass over the fact that the illegal U.S. invasion of Iraq and the destruction of its civil society is the major, if not the source, of ISIS-related terrorism emanating from the Middle East? Is that something we have not paid sufficient attention to, do you think, Nancy?
I don't know. I feel like it's something that comes up in some context in every one of these stories we write and every policy decision that's been made in the region since then. I have to tell you, I have this debate with my Iraqi friends all the time, and often where we sort of differ is not about whether the 2003 invasion was sort of the first domino to fall, but what responsibility do the Iraqis have in trying to rebuild a state that isn't so sectarian-based? I mean, you can argue that the U.S. created that system with the kind of government it formed, but where is the Iraqi responsibility in sort of rebuilding the state? I say say that because your previous caller talked about why not put in money towards reconstruction. There were actually billions put in and billions stolen by Iraqi elected leaders. And so I wish it were as simple as just remove the military and put money into the state, because that hasn't proven to be a successful approach either.
You know, in Sean's comments on the phone, Jeff, it seemed to me you heard some echoes of the debate that's going on in Great Britain now.
Over whether to be involved in Syria.
Yes, and now we have all these immigrants coming in, creating problems, and we should, I mean, he's basically arguing we should withdraw a bit from the world, right? Because we can't solve these problems and we just get enmeshed in them.
Absolutely, that's been a big part of the Brexit debate. The people who want to leave the EU, they sense want to try and set up a bit of a fortress. One of the main phrases they use is we can take control of our destiny by leaving the EU, and that somehow we can isolate ourselves from these problems and just block ourselves off with the English Channel, and we'll be cut off from all the turmoil in the Middle East. Most people think that's a very naive, kind of head-in-the-sand type of view, but it's definitely part of the underlying political debate.
You know, when the referendum got started, I think there was some skepticism it could pass. Now polls show it very close. Have you been surprised by the success that it's had so far, whether or not it passes next week?
Very much so. I mean, one of the striking things is that the elite of opinion amongst economists and so on has been absolutely almost overwhelming, saying that's a very, very, very bad idea. But really, another echo of the Trump phenomenon here, there's a very strong anti-elite opinion amongst the UK voters at the moment. They really don't care so much that all these bigwigs at the IMF and the OECD are telling them that's a bad idea, and that they don't respect institutions in the same way that we're seeing some of this revolt against the establishment that's been bolstering Donald Trump.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Let's talk briefly about this deal Iran is negotiating with Boeing. What do we know about this, Yoki?
We know two things. One, it's enormous. It's potentially worth tens of billions of dollars, although the exact size is not yet known. It also means that you will have American planes flying the friendly skies of Iran for the first time since 1979. This is the second major deal Iran has signed with aircraft makers. The first was with Airbus earlier in January. But this is interesting for a lot of reasons. One, it's an American company. It's an American company that builds a lot of the U.S. civilian fleet. Boeing has military contracts. But also because it's still not clear exactly what an American company doing business in Iran has to go through to do business in Iran. And the Supreme Leader, who loves to use Twitter, we've nicknamed in our office, we call him the Ayatollah, because he just loves to tweet out things at the U.S. He's tweeted out repeatedly that the sanctions haven't been lifted, regulations are still unclear, and he's willing to tear up the deal because of it. So it's interesting that you have the Ayatollah saying it's still not moving quickly enough, you have Boeing signing a deal, and you have Washington saying we still don't quite know how you, Boeing, will do business without running afoul of sanctions.
This could solidify, though, or improve U.S.-Iranian relations, right? A business relationship, the purchase of a huge number of these airplanes?
Well, it would be the first major contract signing since the Iran deal was negotiated. But you're hearing Republicans coming out and great opposition to it. For Iran, this would be an opportunity to improve its aging fleet. But it's interesting that even in this debate, the Iran deal might have been signed, but from both sides, you still hear reference to the great Satan in Iran and hear to the rhetoric about Iran and its role in things like Syria and everything else, that even though the ink is dried on the contract, it hasn't changed attitudes. And this is potentially the very first step in it. But where it goes and how long it'll take before we start to see substantive changes in terms of how the rhetoric is exchanged between the two countries, we'll have to wait and see.
Jeff?
I think symbolic is very important, because what you've seen since the Iran deal was signed was it was supposed to be a case of Iran agrees to give up in its nuclear weapons program, at least for a certain number of years, and get sanctions relief in return. But since then, you've seen a whole bunch of particularly European banks and companies afraid to go back into Iran, even though in theory the sanctions, and many of the sanctions, can be lifted, because they're afraid that the U.S. authorities are going to find some way to catch them up on the remaining sanctions that exist. So seeing that a big U.S. company with the approval of the U.S. government is doing such a high-profile deal in Iran might help change some of the sentiment amongst other countries in the world, whether or not it's safe to go back into Iran or not.
Nancy, you said some Republicans are against this. Republicans are usually in favor of commerce. Why are they against this deal?
Because it's the Iran deal, and they're opposed to that. And as Jeff pointed out, that this would be sort of sanctioning the deal and showing its potential progress and economic development within Iran. And so, realistically, this is a potential political win for the president, and they're not going to give him that easily.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about those Russian hackers attacking the Democratic National Committee computer system in search of knowledge of Donald Trump. And we're going to take your calls. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Nancy Youssef, Senior Defense and National Security Correspondent for The Daily Beast. Jeff Dyer, he's the author of The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China and How America Can Win. And Yoki Driessen, he's the author of The Invisible Front. Well, this is just in. The global governing body for track and field has just announced that Russia's track and field team has been barred from competing in this summer's Rio Games because of a far-reaching doping conspiracy. Yoki, I think there's some sense that this has never happened before in Olympics history.
It's sort of mind-boggling. I mean, this stems back in some cases to a really extraordinary piece of writing in the New York Times where they had done a deep investigative piece about systematic Russian doping during the Sochi Olympics, where basically the Russian intelligence service was helping to sneak clean urine in and, you know, drugged urine out. So you really think about that. Like the equivalent of the Russian FBI and CIA were helping athletes cheat. And that raised the immediate question of, should Sochi be revisited? Should those gold medals be revoked? And there was enormous pressure because Russia's been accused of cheating in tournaments other than the Olympics to do what has just been done. It was thought that it couldn't possibly happen because Russia is enormous. Russia has hosted the Olympics recently and spent $50 or $60 billion doing so. They have denied the charges. But for this to happen in advance of Rio, which is already losing people because of Zika, the fact that they've just impeached their president, their water supply is full of disgusting toilet-esque things. I mean, these Olympics will be potentially catastrophic, and the fact that Russia is being pulled out of them, it's just further evidence of how bad these are likely to be.
Nancy. And Russia seemed to recognize that because literally all the way up until pretty much the last minute, they were making claims, no, we're going to make reforms, we take this seriously. And it fell to a committee that was less than reassured there'd be real changes.
What do you think of this, Jeff?
Well, I think, as Yoki said, it's just another black mark for the Rio Olympics that are just, it's just becoming, you know, very, very, very complicated with Zika, you know, with the fact that the president has been suspended and she's probably going to be actually formally, finally impeached during the Olympics. Their economy is in collapse. However, as someone, I got married in Rio, I'm very, very fond of the city, I would say that I still think it'll probably end up, the Olympics always has this dynamic where in the months beforehand it seems like everything's falling apart, it seems that everything's terrible, but as long as it looks good and as long as the facilities are okay, it's such an extraordinary spectacle that we in the media, we tend to switch to a different dynamic as soon as it starts and we declare it a great success. So I wouldn't write off the Olympics just yet, but it's full of problems and it's going to be very, very controversial.
You know, I wonder if we ought to give some credit to the IAAF, which is that global governing body for track and field, for taking action, because we know that that is often a difficult thing to get governing bodies to do.
Right, especially against a country that's as powerful, wealthy, and rich as Russia. I mean, think about this in comparison to the World Cup, where Qatar has been credibly accused of effectively using slave labor to build facilities for soccer tournament that will be held in 120-degree heat that they clearly got by bribing the officials who awarded the World Cup. There's been pressure for that to be revisited, pressure for it to be canceled or moved. It hasn't happened. Russia is a bigger country, a richer country, and a more powerful country, and these bodies felt that they had the ability to stand up to it.
While we're talking about Russia, we should talk about another extraordinary story this week, which reports that Russian hackers associated with the Russian government broke into the computer network of the Democratic National Committee, one of them for a year monitoring information interested, apparently, in Donald Trump. Nancy, have you ever heard of such a thing?
No. I mean, we've heard about hacking of campaign headquarters, I guess most infamously at the Watergate. But this kind of effort by a foreign government to find out about a presidential candidate who they allegedly were eager to endorse as much as the Russians are going to endorse a presidential candidate anyway. And so this was discovered. There have been two hacks, one in the last year, as you made reference to, and this one in particular, in which they went after all the Democratic National Committee, and all the opposition information they had about Donald Trump. So whatever they could come up with in terms of attacking Donald Trump, which I find kind of interesting because presumably that'll all come out in the public at some point during the election. So I don't know if Russia is sort of hedging its bets about how to sort of get at Donald Trump should he be president now that they know everything that the Democratic National Committee knows about means to attack him or whatnot. But it was an extraordinary breach. And it really and the interesting thing is you had two different hacks. It appears by two different parts of the Russian government, although the Russians officially deny it, that didn't seem to know that the other was hacking different parts of the DNC. So the Russian cyber campaign against, we've already seen against the State Department and other government offices, and now the DNC has just been quite thorough.
Jeff, or maybe I'm just naive. I mean, do you think that that U.S.-backed government hackers are, I guess there's not a DNC equivalent in Russia, but targeting party headquarters in foreign capitals to get information that might be had there?
Well, I think the Edward Snowden revelations suggest us that that's absolutely the case, and I'm sure the NSA is doing precisely this kinds of thing. I mean, from one level, it seems a fairly obvious target for the Russians to go after. It's a private organization, so it's much less security than a government computer system would be. But the fascinating thing is, you know, what do they want to do with this information? Do they just want to try and find out what people know about Donald Trump, because maybe he might be president, and so they need to know? Or are they going to start leaking this information selectively during the campaign in some way to try and influence the campaign? We already saw one, what seemed to be a leak from this hack earlier this week. A big dossier of information appeared on that. It was, from a journalistic point of view, it was kind of disappointing. I mean, it was basically a sort of clippings exercise of a Google search. There was none of the real, actual, you know, exclusive research we would imagine that the DNC and the Clinton campaign are doing on Donald Trump. But we don't know. Maybe there'll be other things will be leaked in the coming days and months.
It's still early in the campaign.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are two parts of this that really jumped out at me, one slightly lighter and one slightly more serious. The lighter one is Donald Trump looks like the most pro-Putin candidate the U.S. has seen ever. He speaks of Putin as a strong man who knows how to deal with the pesky media, a smart man, a strong man, and Putin has returned the love and spoken highly about Trump. So it is interesting that they're trying to find out the negative stuff about a person who is the most positive towards the leader. The slightly more serious one, and I don't want to speak for Nancy or Jeff, but other colleagues might have had the same experience, when they've been visiting foreign leaders doing interviews with us, we ask them questions, and then almost in the ones I've done recently, at some point in the interview, that stops, and they ask questions of me about Trump. You know, world leaders are baffled. They're trying to figure out what if what he says is true, what's bluster. And that's never really happened before, where you've had this many world leaders genuinely confused, baffled, terrified about a major party's presidential candidate.
Well, Nancy and Jeff, have you had that happen too?
Oh, absolutely. And they're confused about what Donald Trump says, because so many of his policy statements both outlandish and contradictory. But there's another issue where they don't quite know who to talk to. With another campaign, there would be, by this stage, there'd be whole layers of advisors who embassies in Washington would connect with, and they'd get a briefing of what the candidate really thinks about these things and what they should be thinking about his statements. But in the Trump case, it's very hard for a lot of embassies to find out who to actually connect with, who to talk to in the Trump campaign to try and get them to explain what it is that he really thinks.
Nancy, what are you hearing?
Well, I would say not just in our capacities, but just in travel. I was in India recently, and I was at the airport, and the man barely spoke English. He figured out I was American, and the first word he said to me was, Trump? So you get this sense of curiosity around the world, and I can tell you my friends in the Middle East are just fascinated by the developments here. So you get it in I think we get it in our jobs and some of the people we interact with, but just stepping out into the world, and you'll hear the confusion about what does he stand for? What does it mean for U.S. foreign policy?
So there's curiosity, and of course he's a less familiar figure on the world stage in governmental terms anyway than previous presidential nominees. Is there also concern about the substance of what he's saying, Yoki?
A deep concern. I mean, if you're a European country, you're scared about the fact that he says NATO's obsolete and the U.S. should get out. Plus, he says Russia is a country he can do business with. Putin's a leader he can do business with. If you're Israel, you worry about where he is on the Israel-Palestine question. If you're in Asia, you wonder about him saying Japan and South Korea should just develop their own nuclear weapons so the U.S. could leave. I think there's almost literally no part of the world where full of U.S. allies, where leaders of those countries aren't terrified about what Trump is saying about their countries.
Yeah, I mean, just take, you know, the Europeans or the Asians. I mean, he's talked about maybe pulling out of NATO, you know, withdrawing some of the assistance to the Japanese and South Koreans, allowing them to have nuclear weapons. If those policies were actually implemented, those would fundamentally change the way those countries think about their security, think about their foreign policy. These would be revolutions in their foreign policy. So this is not just something where it's a bit of campaign rhetoric. I mean, these are hugely vast changes in both U.S. policy with fundamental implications for these countries. So inevitably, they're very freaked out.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Kathy. She's calling us from Sarasota, Florida. Kathy, thank you for holding on.
Yeah, I'm very upset about some of the comments some of the reporters were talking about earlier regarding the Iran Boeing deal, because, you know, the slant on this show is so liberal. You know, there's some of us out here concerned about a country that has such poor human rights. They have no integrity. And the reporters are just so cavalier. It's like, oh, they're just holding back progress or something. It's not that we're holding back progress. This country's not trustworthy. They've already done things that are, you know, violating the deal several times, and there's nothing that's being done about it. And now they seem to approve of this Boeing going down there, fixing up all their airplanes. You know, that's just ridiculous.
So, Kathy, I think one of the arguments being made is it would strengthen ties, make it more likely that Iran would abide by other deals made, like the nuclear deal. But you think that this airplane deal would be bad for the United States?
To me, I do think it's bad for us, because we're dealing with a country that has a history of not being trustworthy. They've never done anything or abided by anything that they've agreed to in the past. They do not have the same, their human rights against women are horrendous. They're just people that I just don't trust, and I don't think that we should be validating any kind of deal with them when they've already violated the terms of this agreement.
All right, Kathy, thank you very much for your call and hearing your perspective. Now, first, this Kathy's statement that they've already violated terms of the Iran nuclear deal, is that correct?
They violated things that are in the spirit of the deal, but not necessarily the deal itself. I think a lot of what Kathy's saying on the substance of it is correct. I mean, they've done a series of ballistic missile tests, which were not explicitly covered as part of the nuclear deal, but the U.S. sort of, I think, wink-nodded, assumed that that would not happen. There's talk in Congress about putting new sanctions on Iran because of the ballistic missile tests. All of us know Jason Rezaian, an American journalist who was kept in brutal captivity by the Iranians, so no journalist, I think, in the U.S., is sort of cavalier about the Iranian human rights record. People, we have personal connections to it. Iran is still meddling with Hezbollah on the borders with Israel. Iran is fighting on behalf of Assad in Syria. So there's very little doubt that they are doing many, many things that are directly contradictory to what the U.S. had hoped they would do.
Yes, the argument for the nuclear deal is that before the deal, Iran was maybe 2 or 3 months away from having enough material to build a nuclear bomb. Under the deal, at least for the next 10 to 15 years, it's probably about a year away from it. That's the main argument for it. The other stuff about, well, maybe this would be a bridge to some sort of rapprochement or reconciliation, or at least a moderately less bad relationship with Iran, those are potential benefits that might have some upside for the U.S., but that's not the meat of it. The meat of it was to make Iran further away from having a nuclear weapon.
Kathy, thanks for your call. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've gotten a lot of feedback on the first topic we talked about, which was the letter, the document that was signed by 51 State Department officials urging stronger action and targeted airstrikes on the Assad regime. Here's one listener who writes, if we attack Assad, we're heating our proxy war with Russia. And another emailer, Nick, says, do any of your guests believe implementing a military campaign in Syria can be conducted without a direct military confrontation with Russia? Is that a risk here?
It's certainly a risk because you have Russian airplanes. I mean, Vladimir Putin announced, what was it, 6 weeks ago or so, that he was pulling out of Syria on mission accomplished, but actually didn't. He still has attack aircraft. He still has planes. He's still bombing. So if you had U.S. planes and Russian planes flying in the same airspace, it's a very real possibility, even just of an accident, of a U.S. bomb hitting a Russian target on the ground, of a U.S. plane hitting a Russian plane. I think it's a very real risk.
Here's a tweet from Emma on this topic. She writes, Obama has kept us out of a senseless war that has nothing to do with the U.S. Don't send troops.
Well, there's one of the ironies of this memo is that this is officials at the State Department calling for U.S. military action against the Assad regime. But as Nancy mentioned earlier, the Pentagon itself is often there are different views in the Pentagon, but it's often much more skeptical about this. One of the reasons being the risk of getting involved in a confrontation with Russia, but also they are probably a bit more skeptical of the idea that some of them would have the same view as President Obama, that if you start along this line of attacking the Assad regime, then you end up getting drawn much more directly into this conflict yourself, and that. that's something they want to avoid.
I just want to address something that Emma mentioned about not dragging troops into Syria. There are U.S. troops in Syria right now. There are at least 250 special forces that are working side by side with local Kurdish and Arab forces. They have gotten as close as 18 miles from Raqqa, which is the ISIS capital, and they are near Manbij, which is a city that the U.S. Is working with Kurdish and Arab forces to try to liberate. It is a key thoroughway for ISIS from Turkey into Syria. And so one of the things that I think the administration has really tried to not talk about is that U.S. troops are in Syria and they are very close to the front lines.
Is there a risk that that military involvement could get bigger?
Well, it has gotten bigger because remember when it started, it was 50 advisors. Even the war itself against ISIS, remember, it started as no boots on the ground, then no combat boots on the ground, then troops in Iraq, then 50 advisors in Syria, and now we have at least 250 more. So we're starting to see these slow increments in terms of U.S. involvement and engagement, and not just in numbers, but they're in proximity to the front lines of the war itself.
Here's another tweet on the subject. Aren't the diplomats urging strikes against Assad years too late for the strikes to be useful? Is it too late, Yogi?
I mean, what's interesting is if you look back at 2010-11, you had basically the entire Obama war cabinet, including then-Secretary of State Clinton. So you had, you know, the previous top U.S. diplomat universally arguing in favor of arming the Syrian rebels because at that time it was thought Assad is losing territory, he's losing ground, they're gaining ground, he might actually be willing to do a deal. At this point, if you're Assad, you are winning. You have Russian backing, you have Iranian backing, you have Hezbollah backing. The moderate opposition has been decimated. The U.S. has not armed them. The U.S. is not really bombing with any seriousness. Why would you make a deal?
Jeff, you mentioned reaction around the world to the Orlando shootings and the reaction on behalf of the LGBT community. And we saw a reflection of that, I thought, in Great Britain this week when Prince William appeared on the cover of a leading gay magazine. Was that a big deal?
It's one of these interesting events where even 2 or 3 years ago, this would have been a huge deal. It's very interesting to happen now, but actually it isn't that big a deal. It almost seems a fairly normal thing that the heir to the throne in the UK would appear on the cover of a gay magazine.
But it's never just happened before.
It has never happened before, yeah. But I think it's a sign that the culture has changed so much, I think both in the UK and in the US around these issues, that it seems fantastically uncontroversial.
At the same time, though, it's been very depressing to watch Republicans try to argue that this was not a hate crime. And that gays were not the target. It took days before you had some leading Republicans acknowledge that, no, this was a hate crime directed at gays. Jeff Sessions said it was just a nightclub. Another Republican said it was a nightclub popular with women, which is emphatically not the case in the case of Pulse. But it is true, I think, in Britain you have leaders, it's not a big deal. Here it's not a big deal for President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden to explicitly say, we stand with the LGBT community, this was a hate crime. But you had Republicans refuse to acknowledge that that's what it was.
And Republicans may have done that, but Donald Trump, for one, reached out explicitly to gay voters for support in the wake of this, as did Hillary Clinton. And that also reflects, I think, the changing times that we see. Well, I want to thank our panel for being with us this hour. Jeff Dyer, Nancy Youssef, Yoki Driesen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boteed, Susan Casey, Danielle Knight, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Alex Drewenskis. Danielle Brown answers the phones. Visit brshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.